Side 4, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 112. Annius still has a simple majority. He can bull through anything that isn't a matter of substance. His toadies are calling for votes on just about anything that comes up. He wants to keep a running count, for one thing, and the voting keeps us all locked in the audience chamber. The numbers are about to change, Your Grace, Comier said. My friends and I have decided to participate this time. Now that's unusual, Patriarch Emban said. The preceptors of the militant orders haven't participated in a vote of the hierocracy for 200 years. We're still welcome, aren't we, Your Grace? As far as I'm concerned, you are, Your Grace. Annius might not like it too much, though. How very unfortunate for him. What does that do to the numbers, Talon?
It just went up from 69 votes to 71 and a fraction, my Lord Comier. That's the 60% Annius needs to win.
And a simple majority?
He still got that. He only needs 61.
I don't think any of the neutral patriarchs will go over to him on a matter of substance until he meets their price, Dolmant said. They'll probably abstain, and then Annius needs... He frowned, thinking hard.
66 votes, Your Grace, Talon supplied. He's one vote short.
Delightful boy, Dolmant murmured. Our best course, then, is to make every vote a vote of substance, even a vote to light more candles. How do we do that? Comier asked. I'm a little rusty on the procedure.
Dolmant smiled faintly. One of us rises to his feet and says, substance.
Won't we just be voted down? Emban chuckled. Oh, no, my dear Comier, he said. A vote on whether a question is a matter of substance or not is itself a matter of substance. I think we've got him, Dolmant. That one vote he doesn't have will keep him off the Archprelate's throne.
Unless he can get his hands on some money, Dolmant said.
Or unless more patriarchs happen to die. How many of us does he have to kill in order to win, Talon?
All of you might help him a bit. Talon grinned.
Mind your manners, Bayret barked.
Sorry, Talon apologized. I should have added Your Grace, I suppose. Annius needs to reduce the total number voting by at least 2 in order to have the 60% he needs, Your Grace.
We'll have to assign knights to protect the loyal patriarchs, then, Abriel said. And that's going to reduce the number out in the city trying to locate the missing members. It's starting to hinge on taking control of the streets. We need Worgen very badly.
Emban looked at him, puzzled.
It's something we came up with at Deimos, Your Grace, Abriel explained. Annius is intimidating patriarchs because Kyrellos is awash with church soldiers. If a patriarch, either you or Patriarch Dolmant, declares a religious crisis and orders Worgen to suspend operations down in Arsham and to bring his armies here to Kyrellos, the whole picture changes. The intimidation starts going the other way at that point.
Abriel, Dolmant said in a pained voice, we do not elect an archprelate by intimidation.
We live in the real world, Your Grace, Abriel replied. Annius was the one who chose the rules of this game, so we're obliged to play his way, unless you happen to have another set of dice.
Besides, Talon added, it would give us at least one more vote.
Oh? Dolmant said.
Patriarch Bergston's with Worgen's army. We could probably persuade him to vote right, couldn't we?
Why don't we put our heads together and compose a letter to the King of Thalesia, Dolmant? Emban grinned. I was just about to suggest that myself, Emban. And perhaps we should forget to tell anyone else about it. Conflicting orders from some other patriarch would just confuse Worgen, and he's confused enough as it is.
Chapter 8 Sparhawk was tired, but he slept poorly. His mind seemed filled with numbers. 69 changed into 71, then 80, then back, and the 9 and 17, no, 15, hovered ominously in the background. He started to lose track of what the numbers meant, and they became just numbers that arrayed themselves threateningly before him, armored and with weapons in their hands. And, as it almost always did when he slept now, the shadowy thing haunted his dreams. It did not do anything, but merely watched and waited. Sparhawk did not really have the temperament for politics. Too many things reduced themselves in his mind to battlefield imagery, and superior strength and training and individual bravery counted for much on a battlefield. In politics, however, the feeblest were equal to the strongest. A palsied hand shakingly raised to vote had a power equal to that of a mailed fist. His instincts told him that the solution to the problem rested in his scabbard, but the killing of the primate of Simera would tear the West apart at a time when Otha stood armed and poised on the eastern marches. He finally gave up and slipped quietly from his bed to avoid waking the sleeping Kaltan. He put on his soft monk's robe and padded through the night-dark halls to Domant's study. Sophronia was there, sitting before a small fire that crackled on the hearth, her teacup in her hands, and her eyes a mystery. "You're troubled, aren't you, dear one?" she said to him quietly. "Aren't you?" He sighed and sank into a chair, extending his long legs out in front of him. "We're not suited for this, little mother," he said moodily. "Neither one of us. I'm not arranged in such a way that I can palpitate with delight over the change of a number, and I'm not positive that you even understand what numbers mean. Since Styrix don't read, can any of you actually understand any number larger than the sum of your fingers and toes?"
"Are you trying to be insulting, Sparhawk?"
"No, little mother, I could never do that, not to you. I'm sorry. I'm a bit sour this morning. I'm fighting the kind of war I don't understand. Why don't we frame some sort of prayer and ask Afriel to change the minds of certain members of the hierocracy? That would be nice and simple and probably head off a great deal of bloodshed."
"Afriel wouldn't do that, Sparhawk."
"I was afraid you might say that. That leaves us the unpleasant alternative of playing somebody else's game then, doesn't it? I wouldn't mind so much if I understood the rules a little better. Frankly, I'd much prefer swords and oceans of blood." He paused. "Go ahead and say it, Sophronia."
"Say what?"
"Sigh, and roll your eyes heavenward and say, 'Illeans,' in your most despairing tone." Her eyes went hard.
"That was uncalled for, Sparhawk."
"I was only teasing you." He smiled. "We can do that with those we love without giving offense, can't we?" Patriarch Dolmant entered quietly, his face troubled. "Is no one sleeping tonight?" he asked. "We have a big day ahead of us tomorrow, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied. "Is that why you're up as well?" Dolmant shook his head. "One of my servants fell ill," he explained. "A cook. I don't know why the other servants sent for me. I'm no physician."
"I think it's called trust, Your Grace."
Sophronia smiled.
"You're supposed to have certain special contacts with the Aline God. How is the poor fellow? The cook, I mean."
"It appears to be quite serious. I sent for a physician. He isn't much of a cook, but I'd rather he didn't die. But now tell me, what really happened in Simera, Sparhawk?"
Sparhawk quickly sketched in the events that had occurred in the throne room and the substance of the confession of Lycaeus.
"Otha!" Dolmant exclaimed. "Annius actually went that far?"
"We can't really prove it, Your Grace," Sparhawk told him. "It might be useful at some point to let the information drop in Annius' presence, however. It might throw him off balance a bit. Anyway, at Alana's command, we've confined Lycaeus and Orissa in that cloister near Deimos, and I'm carrying a sizable number of warrants for the arrest of assorted people on charges of high treason. Annius' name figures quite prominently in one of those warrants." He paused. "There's a thought," he said. "We could march the knights to the Basilica, arrest Annius, and take him back to Simera in chains. Elana was talking very seriously of hangings and beheadings when we left."
"You can't take Annius out of the Basilica, Sparhawk," Dolmant said. "It's a church, and a church is sanctuary for all civil crimes."
"Pity," Sparhawk murmured.
"Who's in charge of Annius' toadies in the Basilica?"
"Markova, Patriarch of Coom. He's been more or less running things for the past year. Markova's an ass, totally venal, but he's an expert on church law, and he knows 100 technicalities and loopholes."
"Is Annius attending the meetings?" Most of the time, yes. He likes to keep a running count of the votes. He's spending his spare time making offers to the neutral patriarchs. Those 9 men are very shrewd. They never come right out and openly accept his offers. They answer with their votes. "Would you like to watch us play, little mother?" Dolmant said it with a faint irony.
"Thank you all the same, Dolmant," she declined. "But there are a goodly number of Alines who are firmly convinced that if Asteric ever enters the Basilica, the dome will fall in on itself. I don't enjoy being spat on all that much, so I think I'll stay here if I may."
"When have the meetings usually been commencing?" Sparhawk asked the Patriarch.
"It varies," Dolmant replied. "Markova holds the chair. That was a simple majority vote. He's been playing with his authority. He calls the meetings on a whim, and the messengers delivering those calls somehow always seem to lose their way when they come looking for those of us opposed to Annius. I think Markova started out by trying to slip through a substantive vote while the rest of us were still in bed."
"What if he calls a vote in the middle of the night, Dolmant?" Sophronia asked.
"He can't," Dolmant explained. "Sometime in antiquity, some patriarch with nothing better to do codified the rules dealing with meetings of the hierocracy. History tells us that he was a tiresome old windbag with an obsession about meaningless detail. He was the one responsible for the absurd rule about the 100 votes, or 60%, on substantive matters. He also, probably out of pure whim, set down the rule that the hierocracy could only deliberate during the hours of daylight. Many of his rules are stupid frivolities, but he talked for 6 straight weeks. And finally, his brothers voted to accept his rules just to shut him up."
Dolmant touched his cheek reflectively. "When all this is over, I may just nominate the silly ass for sainthood. Those petty, ridiculous rules of his may be all that's keeping Annius off the throne right now. At any rate, we've made a practice of all being in place at dawn just to be safe. It's a rather petty form of retaliation, actually. Markova's not customarily an early riser, but he's been greeting the sun with the rest of us for the past several weeks. If he's not there, we can vote in a new chairman and proceed without him. All sorts of inconvenient votes could take place."
"Couldn't he just have those votes repealed?" she asked.
Dolmant actively smirked. "A vote to repeal is a matter of substance, Sophronia, and he doesn't have the votes." There was a respectful knock on the door, and Dolmant answered it. A servant spoke with him for a moment. "That cook just died," Dolmant said to Sparhawk and Sophronia, sounding a bit shocked. "Wait here a moment. The physician wants to talk with me."
"Strange," Sparhawk murmured.
"People do die of natural causes, Sparhawk," Sophronia told him.
"Not in my profession, at least not very often."
"Maybe he was old."
Dolmant returned, his face very pale.
"He was poisoned," he exclaimed.
"What?" Sparhawk demanded.
"That cook of mine was poisoned. And the physician says that the poison was in the porridge the man was preparing for breakfast. That porridge could have killed everyone in the house."
"Perhaps you'd like to reconsider your position on the notion of arresting Annius, your grace?" Sparhawk said grimly.
"Surely you don't believe—"
Dolmant broke off, his eyes suddenly very wide.
"He's already had a hand in the poisoning of Aldreas and Alana, your grace," Sparhawk said. "I doubt that he'd choke very much over a few patriarchs and a score or so church knights."
"The man's a monster!"
Then Dolmant started to swear, using oaths more common to a barracks than a theological seminary.
"You'd better tell Emban to circulate word of this to the patriarchs loyal to us, Dolmant," Sophronia advised. "It appears that Annius may have come up with a cheaper way to win an election."
"I'd better start rousing the others," Sparhawk said, rising to his feet. "I want to tell them about this, and it takes a while to get into full armor." It was still dark when they set out for the Basilica, accompanied by 15 armored knights from each of the 4 orders. 60 church knights, it had been decided, was a force with which few would care to interfere. The sky to the east was beginning to show that first pale stain of daylight when they reached the great domed church that was at the very center of the holy city, its thought and spirit as well as its geography. The entrance into the city of the column of Pandions, Cyrenix, Genidians, and Alcyones the previous night had not gone unnoticed, and the torchlit bronze portal leading into the vast court before the basilica was guarded by 100 and a half red-tunicked church soldiers, under the command of that same captain who, at Makova's orders, had attempted to prevent the departure of Sparhawk and his companions from the Pandion chapter house on their journey to Borata.
"Halt!"
he commanded in an imperious, even insulting tone.
"Would you attempt to deny entrance to patriarchs of the church, Captain?"
Preceptor Abriel asked in a level tone.
"Knowing that you thereby imperil your soul?"
"His neck, too," Euloth muttered to Tinian.
"Patriarch Dolmant and Patriarch Emban may freely enter, my lord," the captain said. "No true son of the church could refuse them entry."
"But what of these other patriarchs, Captain?" Dolmant asked him.
"I see no other patriarchs, your grace."
The captain's tone hovered on insult.
"You're not looking, Captain," Emban told him. "By church law, the preceptors of the militant orders are also patriarchs. Stand aside and let us pass." "I have heard of no such church law." "Are you calling me a liar, Captain?"
Emban's normally good-humored face had gone iron hard.
"Why, certainly not, your grace. May I consult with my superiors on this matter?" "You may not. Stand aside."
The captain started to sweat.
"I thank your grace for correcting my error," he floundered. "I was not aware that the preceptors also enjoyed ecclesiastical rank. All patriarchs may freely enter. The rest, I'm afraid, must wait outside."
"He'd better be afraid if he's going to try to enforce that," Euloth grated.
"Captain," Preceptor Comier said, "all patriarchs are entitled to a certain administrative staff, aren't they?"
"Certainly, my lord, your grace."
"These knights are our staff. Secretaries and the like, you understand. If you deny them entrance, I'll expect to see a long file of the black-robed underlings of the other patriarchs filing out of the basilica in about 5 minutes." "I can't do that, your grace," the captain said stubbornly.
"Euloth," Comier barked.
"If I may, your grace," Bavier interposed.
Bavier, Sparhawk noted, was holding his Lochaber axe loosely in his right hand. "The captain and I have met before. Perhaps I can reason with him." The young Cyrenic knight moved his horse forward.
"Though our relations have never been cordial, Captain," he said, "I beseech you not to so risk your soul by defying our Holy Mother the Church. With this in mind, will you freely stand aside as the Church has commanded you to do?"
"I will not, Sir Knight."
Bavier sighed regretfully. Then, with an almost negligent swing of his dreadful axe, he sent the captain's head flying. Bavier, Sparhawk had noted, did that on occasion. Just as soon as he was certain that he was on firm theological ground, the young Arshan habitually took sometimes shockingly direct action. Even now his face was serene and untroubled as he watched the captain's headless body standing stock still for several seconds, and then he sighed as the body collapsed. The church soldiers gasped and cried out in horror and alarm as they recoiled and reached for their weapons.
"That tears it," Tinian said. "Here we go."
He reached for his sword.
"Dear friends,"
Bavier addressed the soldiers in a gentle but commanding voice,
"you have just witnessed a truly regrettable incident. A soldier of the church has willfully defied our mother's lawful command. Let us join together now to offer up a fervent prayer that all merciful God shall see fit to forgive his dreadful sin. Kneel, dear friends, and pray."
Bavier shook the blood off his axe, spattering a number of soldiers in the process. First a few, then more, and finally all of the soldiers sank to their knees.
"O God," Bavier led them in prayer, "we beseech thee to receive the soul of our dear brother, but recently departed, and grant him absolution for his grievous sin."
He looked around.
"Continue to pray, dear friends," he instructed the kneeling soldiers. "Pray not only for your former captain, but for yourselves as well, lest sin, ever devious and cunning, creep into your hearts even as it crept into his. Defend your purity and humility with vigor, dear friends, lest you share your captain's fate."
Then the Cyrenic knight, all in burnished steel and pristine white surcoat and cape, moved his horse forward at a walk, threading his way through the ranks of the kneeling soldiers, bestowing blessings with one hand and holding his Lochaber axe in the other.
"I told you he was a good boy," Euloth said to Tinian,
as the party followed the beatifically smiling Bavier.
"I never doubted it for a moment, my friend," Tinian replied.
"Lord Abriel," Patriarch Dolmance said as he guided his horse past the kneeling soldiers, many of whom were actively weeping, "have you questioned Sir Bavier of late on the actual substance of his beliefs? I may be wrong, but I seem to detect certain deviations from the true teachings of our Holy Mother."
"I shall catechize him most penetratingly on the matter, Your Grace, just as soon as I have the opportunity."
"There's no great rush, my lord," Dolmance said benignly. "I don't feel that his soul is in any immediate danger. That is a truly ugly weapon he carries, however."
"Yes, Your Grace," Abriel agreed. "It truly is."
Word of the sudden demise of the offensive captain at the gate spread rather quickly. There was no interference from church soldiers at the massive doors of the basilica. Indeed, there seemed to be no church soldiers around at all. The heavily armed knights dismounted, formed up into a military column, and followed their preceptors and the two patriarchs into the vast nave. There was a noisy clatter as the party knelt briefly before the altar. Then they rose and marched off down a candlelit corridor toward the administrative offices and the archprelate's audience chamber. The men standing guard at the door to the chamber were not church soldiers, but rather were members of the archprelate's personal guard. Their loyalties were to the office itself, and they were totally incorruptible. They were also, however, sticklers for the letter of church law, in which they were probably more well-versed than many of the patriarchs sitting in the chamber. They immediately recognized the ecclesiastical eminence of the preceptors of the four orders. Coming up with a reason why the rest of the entourage should be admitted took a bit longer, however. It was Patriarch Emban, fat, sly, and with a nearly encyclopedic knowledge of church law and custom, who pointed out the fact that any churchman with proper credentials and at the invitation of a patriarch must be freely admitted. Once the guards had agreed to that, Emban gently pointed out that the church knights were de facto churchmen as members of technically cloistered orders. The guards mulled that over, conceded Emban's point, and ceremoniously opened the huge doors. Sparhawk noticed a number of poorly concealed smiles as he and his friends filed inside. The guards, by definition, were incorruptible and totally neutral. This did not, however, preclude their having private opinions. The audience chamber was as large as any secular throne room. The throne itself, massive, ornate, constructed of solid gold and standing on a raised dais backed by purple drapes, was at one end of the hall, and on either side, rising in tier upon tier, stood the high-backed benches. The first four tiers were crimson-cushioned, indicating that those seats were reserved for the patriarchs. Above those seats, and separated from them by velvet ropes of deepest purple, were the plain wooden seats of the galleries for the spectators. A lectern stood before the throne, and Patriarch Makova of Qum in Arsham stood at the lectern, droning out a speech filled with ecclesiastic bombast. Makova, lean-faced, pockmarked, and obviously sleepy, turned irritably as the huge doors opened and the knights followed the patriarchs of Deimos and Eucera into the vast chamber.
"What's the meaning of this?" Makova demanded in an outraged tone.
"Nothing out of the ordinary, Makova," Emban replied. "Dolmant and I are merely escorting some of our brother patriarchs in to join our deliberations."
"I see no patriarchs," Makova snapped.
"Don't be tiresome, Makova. All the world knows that preceptors of the militant orders hold rank equal to ours and are therefore members of the hierocracy."
Makova glanced quickly at a weedy-looking monk sitting off to one side at a table piled high with massive books and ancient scrolls.
"Will the assemblage hear the words of the law clerk on this matter?" he asked.
There was a rumble of assent, though the looks of consternation on the faces of at least some of the patriarchs clearly showed that they already knew the answer. The weedy monk consulted several large tomes, then rose, cleared his throat, and spoke in a rusty-sounding voice.
"His Grace, the Patriarch of Eucera, has correctly cited the law," he said. "The preceptors of the militant orders are indeed members of the hierocracy, and the names of the current holders of those offices have been duly entered in the rolls of this body. The preceptors have not chosen to participate in deliberations for some two centuries past, but they have the rank nonetheless."
"Authority not exercised no longer exists," Makova snapped.
I'm afraid that's not entirely true, Your Grace, the monk apologized. There are many historical precedents for resuming participation. At one time, the patriarchs of the Kingdom of Arsham refused to participate in the deliberations of the hierocracy for 800 years as a result of a dispute over proper vestments, and—
All right, all right, Markovas said angrily.
But these armored assassins have no right to be here. He glared at the knights.
Wrong again, Markova, Emban said smugly. By definition, the church knights are members of religious orders. Their vows are no less binding and legitimate than ours. They are thus churchmen, and may act as observers, provided that they are invited by a sitting patriarch.
He turned. Sir knights, he said, would you be so good as to accept my personal invitation to witness our proceedings?
Markova looked quickly at the scholarly monk, and the weedy fellow nodded.
What it boils down to, Markova, Emban said in an unctuous tone tinged with malice, is that the knights of the church have as much right to be present as the serpent Aeneas, who sits in unearned splendor in the north gallery, chewing his lower lip in dismay, I note.
You go too far, Emban.
I don't really think so, old boy. Shall we take a vote on something, Markova, and find out how much your support has been eroded?
Emban looked around.
But we're interrupting the proceedings. I pray you, my brother patriarchs and dear guests, let us take our seats so that the hierocracy may continue its empty deliberations.
Empty?
Markova gasped.
Totally empty, old boy. Until Clavonus dies, nothing we decide here has any meaning whatsoever. We are simply amusing ourselves. And earning our pay, of course.
That's a very offensive little man, Tinian murmured to Euleth.
Good, though.
The huge Genidian knight grinned. Sparhawk knew exactly where he was going.
You, he muttered to Talon, who had probably been admitted by mistake, come with me.
Where are we going?
To irritate an old friend.
Sparhawk grinned mirthlessly. He led the boy up the stairs to an upper gallery where the emaciated primate of Cimera sat with a writing desk in front of him and a fair number of black-robed sycophants on either side. Sparhawk and Talon went to places on the bench directly behind Aeneas. Sparhawk saw that Euleth, Bayret, and Tinian were following, and he waved them off warningly, even as Dolmant and Emban escorted the armored preceptors to places on the lower, cushioned tiers. Sparhawk knew that Aeneas sometimes blurted things out when he was surprised, and he wanted to find out if his enemy had in any way been involved in the attempted mass poisoning at Dolmant's house that morning.
Why, can that possibly be the primate of Cimera? He said in feigned surprise. What on earth are you doing so far away from home, Aeneas?
Aeneas turned to glare at him.
What are you up to, Sparhawk?
He demanded.
Observing, that's all, Sparhawk replied, removing his helmet and depositing his gauntlets in it.
He unbuckled his shield and removed his sword belt. He leaned them against the back of Aeneas' seat.
Will those be in your way, neighbor? He asked mildly. It's a bit hard to sit down comfortably when you're so encumbered with the tools of your trade, you know.
He sat.
How have you been, Aeneas? I haven't seen you for months now.
He paused.
You're looking a bit gaunt and pasty-faced, old boy. You really ought to get more fresh air and exercise.
Be still, Sparhawk, Aeneas snapped. I'm trying to listen.
Oh, of course. We can have a nice long talk later, catch up on each other's accomplishments and the like.
There was nothing out of the ordinary in Aeneas' reaction, and Sparhawk became a little less certain of the man's guilt.
If it pleases you, my brothers, Dolmant was saying, a number of events have recently occurred, and I feel obligated to report them to the hierocracy. Though our primary tasks are ageless, we nonetheless function in the world and must keep abreast of current events.
Markova looked questioningly up toward Aeneas. The primate took up a quill and a scrap of paper. Sparhawk rested his arms on the back of his enemy's seat and looked over the man's shoulder as he scribbled the terse instruction, "Let him talk."
"Tiresome, isn't it, Aeneas?" Sparhawk said in a pleasant tone. "It would be so much more convenient if you could do your own talking, wouldn't it?"
"I told you to shut up, Sparhawk," Aeneas grated, handing his note to a young monk to carry to Markova.
"My, aren't we testy this morning," Sparhawk observed. "Didn't you sleep well last night, Aeneas?"
Aeneas turned to glare at his tormentor.
"Who's that?"
he demanded, pointing at Talon.
"My page," Sparhawk replied. "It's one of the encumbrances of knightly rank. He sort of fills in while my squire is otherwise occupied."
Makova had glanced at the note.
"We always welcome the words of the learned primate of Deimos," he declaimed loftily. "But please be brief, Your Grace. We have important business to attend to here."
He stepped away from the lectern.
"Of course, Makova," Dolmat replied, stepping to the vacated place. "Briefly, then," he began. "As a result of the full recovery of Queen Alana, the political situation in the kingdom of Elenia has radically changed, and—" Cries of astonishment echoed through the hall, and there was a confused babble of voices. Sparhawk, still leaning on the back of Aeneas' seat, was pleased to see the primate's face grow totally white as he half started to his feet.
"Impossible!"
the churchman gasped.
"Amazing, isn't it, Aeneas?" Sparhawk said. "And so totally unexpected. I'm sure you'll be happy to know that the Queen sends you her very best wishes."
"Explain yourself, Dolmant," Makova half shouted.
"I was only trying to be brief, as you requested, Makova. No more than a week ago, Queen Alana recovered from her mysterious ailment. Many look upon that as miraculous. Upon her recovery, certain facts came to light, and the former Prince Regent, and his mother, I understand, are currently under arrest on the charge of high treason."
Aeneas fell back in his seat in a near faint.
"The revered and respected Earl of Lenda now heads the royal council, and warrants for a number of co-conspirators in the foul plot against the Queen have been issued over his seal. The Queen's champion is presently searching out these miscreants and will doubtless bring them all before the bar of justice, either human or divine."
"The Baron Harperin was next in line to head the Elenian royal council," Makova protested.
"The Baron Harperin is presently standing before the bar of the highest justice, Makova," Dolmant said in a deadly tone. "He faces the ultimate judge. There is, I fear, scant hope for his acquittal, though we may pray that it be otherwise."
"What happened to him?"
Makova gasped.
"I'm told that he was accidentally beheaded during the changeover of administrations in Simera. Regrettable, perhaps, but that sort of thing happens now and then."
"Harperin?"
Aeneas gasped in dismay.
"He made the mistake of offending Preceptor Vanion," Sparhawk murmured in his ear, "and you know how short-tempered Vanion can be at times. He was very sorry afterward, of course, but by then Harperin was lying in two separate places. He absolutely destroyed the carpeting in the council chamber. All that blood, you know."
"Who else are you chasing, Sparhawk?" Aeneas demanded.
"I don't have the list with me at the moment, Aeneas, but there are a number of prominent names on it. Names I'm sure you'd recognize." There was a stir at the door, and two frightened-looking patriarchs crept into the hall and then scurried to places on the red-cushioned benches. Calton stood grinning at the door for a moment, then left again.
"Well?" Sparhawk whispered to Talon.
"Those two bring the total up to 119, Talon whispered back. "We've got 45, and Aeneas still has 65. He needs 72 now instead of 71. We're getting closer, Sparhawk."
It took the secretary of the primate of Simera some while longer to complete his computations. Aeneas scribbled a one-word note to Makova. Sparhawk, watching over the primate's shoulder, read the single word, "Vote." The issue Makova put to the vote was a pure absurdity. Everyone knew that. The only question the vote was designed to answer was upon which side the 9 neutral patriarchs clustered in a now frightened group near the door would come down. After the tally, Makova announced the results in a tone of dismay. The 9 had voted in a block against the primate of Simera. The huge door opened again, and 3 black-robed monks entered. Their cowls were raised, and their pace was ritualistically slow. When they reached the dais, one of their number removed a folded black cover from beneath his robe, and the 3 solemnly spread it over the throne to announce that the arch-prelate Clavonus had finally died.
Chapter 9.
"How long will the city be in mourning?" Tinian asked Dolmant that afternoon when they had gathered once again in the patriarch's study.
"A week," Dolmant replied. "The funeral takes place then."
"And nothing happens during that period?"
the blue-cloaked Alcyone knight asked. No sessions of the hierocracy or anything? Dolmant shook his head. No, we're supposed to spend the period in prayer and meditation. It's a breathing space, Vanion said, and it should give Worgen time to get here. He frowned. We still have a problem, though. Annius doesn't have any more money, and that means that his hold on his majority grows shakier every day. He's probably growing desperate by now, and desperate men do rash things. He's right, Comir agreed. I expect Annius will take to the streets at this point. He'll hold his own votes by terror and try to reduce the number voting by eliminating patriarchs loyal to us until he gets the number down to the point where he has a substantive majority. I think it's time to fort up, gentlemen. We'd better get our friends all together behind some good stout walls where we can protect them. I'll certainly agree, Abriel concurred. Our position is vulnerable right now. Which of your chapter houses is closest to the Basilica? Patriarch Emban asked them. Our friends are going to have to file back and forth through the streets to participate in deliberations. Let's not expose them to any more danger than we have to. Our house is closest, Vanion told him, and it has its own well. After what happened this morning, I don't want to give Annius access to our drinking water.
Supplies? Darylon asked.
We keep enough on hand to withstand a 6-month siege, Vanion replied. Soldiers' rations, I'm afraid, Your Grace, he apologized to the corpulent Emban. Emban sighed. Oh, well, he said. I've been meaning to lose some weight anyway.
It's a good plan, the white-cloaked Perceptor Abriel said. But it does have a drawback. If we're all in one chapter house, the church soldiers can surround us. We'll be penned up inside with no way to get to the Basilica at all.
Then we'll fight our way through, Comir said, cramming his ogre-horned helmet on his head irritably.
Abriel shook his head. People get killed in fights, Comir. The vote is very close. We can't afford to lose a single patriarch at this point.
We can't win either way, Tinian said.
I'm not so sure, Qualton disagreed.
Can you see a way out of it?
I think so.
Qualton looked at Dolmant. I'll need permission for this, Your Grace, he said.
I'm listening.
What's your plan?
If Annius decides to resort to naked force, that means that any semblance of civil order goes out the window, doesn't it?
More or less, yes.
Then if he's not going to pay any attention to the rules, why should we? If we want to cut down on the number of church soldiers surrounding the Pandion chapter house, all we have to do is give them something more important to do.
Set fire to the city again, Talon suggested.
That might be a little extreme, Qualton said. We can keep the notion in reserve, though. Right now, however, the votes Annius has got are the most important things in his life. If we start peeling them off one by one, he'll do just about anything to protect what he's got left, won't he?
I will not allow you to start butchering patriarchs, Qualton, Dolman said in a shocked voice.
We don't have to kill anybody, Your Grace. All we have to do is imprison a few. Annius is fairly intelligent. He'll get the point after a while.
You'll need some kind of charge, Sir Qualton, Abriel said. You can't just imprison patriarchs of the church for no reason at all, regardless of the circumstances.
Oh, we have charges, my lord Abriel. All sorts of charges. But crimes against the crown of Elenia has the nicest ring to it, wouldn't you say?
I hate it when he tries to be clever, Sparhawk muttered to Tinian. You'll love this one, Sparhawk, Qualton said. He threw back his black cloak with an expression of insufferable smugness.
How many of those arrest warrants Lenda signed for you back in Cimera have you still got in your pocket?
8 or 10, why?
Are there any of those people whose company you'd absolutely die without for the next several weeks?
I could probably live without most of them.
Sparhawk thought he saw which way his friend was going.
All we have to do is substitute a few names then, Qualton said. The documents are official, so it's going to look legal, sort of. After we've picked up 4 or 5 of his bought-and-paid-for patriarchs and dragged them off to the Alcyone chapter house, which just happens to be way over on the far side of town, won't Annius do everything in his power to get them back? I'd sort of expect the number of soldiers gathered around the Pandion chapter house to diminish drastically at that point.
Amazing, Euloth said. Qualton actually came up with a workable idea.
About the only thing I can see wrong with it is the business of substituting names, Vanion said. You can't just scratch out one name and replace it with another. Not on an official document.
I didn't say anything about scratching out names, my lord, Calton said modestly.
Once, when we were novices, you gave Sparhawk and me leave to go home for a few days. You scribbled a note to get us out through the gate. We just happened to keep the note. The scribes in the scriptorium have something that totally washes out ink. They use it when they make mistakes. The date on that note of yours kept mysteriously changing. You might almost call it miraculous, mightn't you? He shrugged. But then God's always been sort of fond of me.
Would it work? Comier bluntly asked Sparhawk.
It did when we were novices, my lord, Sparhawk assured him.
You actually knighted these two, Vanion? Abriel asked.
It was a slow week. The grins in the room were broad now.
Totally reprehensible, Calton, Dolmant said. I'd have to absolutely forbid it, if I thought that you were in any way serious about it.
You were just speculating, weren't you, my son?
Oh, absolutely, Your Grace.
I was sure that was the case. Dolmant smiled benignly, even piously, and then he winked.
Oh, dear, Sophronia sighed. Isn't there one honest Aline in the world? You too, Dolmant?
I didn't agree to anything, little mother, he protested with exaggerated innocence. We were only speculating, weren't we, Sir Calton?
Certainly, Your Grace, pure speculation. Neither of us would ever seriously consider something so reprehensible.
My feelings exactly, Dolmant said.
There, Sophronia, does that set your mind at rest?
You were a much nicer boy when you were a Pandion novice, Dolmant, she reproved him.
There was a stunned silence as they all stared at the Patriarch of Deimos.
Oops, Sophronia said mildly, her eyes dancing and a faint smile hovering at the corners of her mouth.
I suppose I really shouldn't have said that, should I have, Dolmant?
Did you really have to do that, little mother? He asked her in a pained tone.
Yes, dear one, I believe I did. You've started to become just a little too impressed with your own cleverness. It's my responsibility as your teacher and your friend to curb that whenever possible.
Dolmant tapped one finger on the table in front of him.
I trust we'll all be discreet about this, gentlemen.
Wild horses couldn't drag it out of us, Dolmant.
Emben grinned.
As far as I'm concerned, I never even heard it. And that'll probably hold true until the next time I need a favor from you.
Were you any good, Your Grace? Calton asked respectfully.
As a Pandion, I mean.
He was the best, Calton, Sophronia said rather proudly. He was even a match for Sparhawk's father. We were all saddened when the church found other duties for him. We lost a very good Pandion when he took holy orders.
Dolmant was still looking around at his friends, his expression suspicious.
I thought I'd buried it completely, he sighed. I never thought you'd betray me, Sophronia.
It's not exactly as if it were shameful, Your Grace, Vanion said.
It might prove to be politically inconvenient, Dolmant said.
At least you were able to control your tongue, brother.
Not to worry, Dolmant, Emben said expansively. I'll keep an eye on your friends here, and as soon as I suspect that one of them is starting to have difficulty controlling his tongue, I'll order him to that monastery at Zemba down in Camoria, where the brothers all take vows of silence.
All right, then, Vanion said. Let's get started, gentlemen. We have a number of friendly patriarchs to round up, and Calton, I want you to go start practicing forgery. The names you'll be substituting on those arrest warrants will have to be in the handwriting of the Earl of Lenda.
He paused thoughtfully, looking at his blonde subordinate.
You'd better take Sparhawk with you, he added.
I can manage, my lord.
Vanion shook his head.
No, Calton, he disagreed. I don't think so. I've seen your attempts at spelling before.
Bad?
Darylon asked him.
Terrible, my friend. Once he wrote down a 6-letter word, and he didn't manage to get a single letter right.
Some words are difficult to spell, Vanion.
His own name?
But you can't do this!
The Patriarch of Cardos protested shrilly as Sparhawk and Calton dragged him from his house a few days later.
You can't arrest a Patriarch of the Church for anything while the Hierocracy's in session!
But the Hierocracy's not in session just now, Your Grace, Sparhawk pointed out. They're in recess during the period of official mourning.
I still cannot be tried by a civil court. I demand that you present these specious charges before an ecclesiastical court.
Take him outside, Sparhawk curtly instructed the black-armored Superain. The Patriarch of Kardos was dragged from the room.
Why the delay? Kalton asked.
Two things. Our prisoner didn't really seem all that surprised at the charges, did he?
Now that you mention it, no.
I think maybe Lenda missed a few names when he was drawing up that list.
That's always possible.
What was the other thing?
Let's send a message to Anius. He knows that we can't touch him as long as he stays inside the Basilica, doesn't he?
Yes.
All right, then. Let's imprison him there and curtail his freedom of movement, for its irritation value, if nothing else. We still owe him for that poisoned cook.
How do you plan to do that?
Watch, and follow my lead.
Don't I always?
They went out to the courtyard of the Patriarch's luxurious house, a house built, Sparhawk was sure, on the backs of the Alanian taxpayers.
My colleague and I have considered your request for an ecclesiastical hearing, Your Grace, the big Pandion said to the prisoner. We find that your argument has merit.
He began to leaf through his sheaf of warrants.
You'll deliver me to the Basilica for a hearing, then?
The Patriarch asked. Sparhawk said absently, still reading.
I said, are you going to take me to the Basilica and present these absurd charges there?
I don't think so, Your Grace. That would really be inconvenient.
Sparhawk pulled out the warrant for the arrest of the Primate of Cimera and showed it to Kalton.
That's the one, all right, Kalton said. That's the fellow we want.
Sparhawk rolled up the warrant and tapped it against his cheek.
"Here's what we're going to do, Your Grace," he said. "We're going to take you to the Alcyone Chapter House and confine you there. These charges originated in the Kingdom of Alania, and any ecclesiastical proceedings would have to be conducted by the head of the church in that kingdom. Since Primate Anius is acting for the Patriarch of Cimera during His Grace's incapacity, that makes him the man who would head up this hearing. Strange how things work out, isn't it? Since Primate Anius is the one in authority in this matter, we'll freely turn you over to him. All he has to do is to come out of the Basilica, go to the Alcyone Chapter House, and order us to turn you over to him.
He glanced at a red-tuniced officer being guarded by the bleak-looking Sir Perrain.
The captain of your guard here will serve as an excellent messenger. Why don't you have a word with him and explain the situation? Then we'll send him to the Basilica to tell Anius about it. Have him ask the good primate to come and visit us. We'll be overjoyed to see him on neutral ground, won't we, Kalton?
Oh, absolutely, Kalton replied fervently.
The Patriarch of Kardos gave them a suspicious look, then quickly conferred with the captain of his guard detachment. He kept glancing at the rolled-up warrant in Sparhawk's hand as he spoke.
Do you think he got the point? Kalton murmured.
I certainly hope so. I did everything but hit him over the head with it.
The Patriarch of Kardos returned, his face stiff with anger.
Oh, one other thing, Captain, Sparhawk said to the church soldier who was preparing to leave.
Would you be so good as to convey a personal message to the Primate of Cimera for us? Tell him that Sir Sparhawk of the Pandion Order invites him to come out from under the dome of Basilica to play in the streets, where certain petty little restrictions won't interfere with our fun.
Curic arrived that evening. He was travel-stained and looked weary. Bayret escorted him into Dolmant's study, and he sank into a chair.
"I'd have been here a bit sooner," he apologized, "but I stopped off in Deimos to see Asladi and the boys. She gets very cross when I ride through town and don't stop."
"How is Asladi?" Patriarch Dolmant asked.
"Fatter,"
Curic smiled. "And I think she's getting a little silly as the years creep up on her. She was feeling nostalgic, so she took me up into the hayloft." His jaw set slightly.
"Later I had a long talk with the boys about letting thistles grow in the hayfield."
"Do you have any idea of what he's talking about, Sparhawk?" Dolmant asked in perplexity.
"Yes, Your Grace. But you're not going to explain it to me, are you?"
"No, Your Grace, I don't think so."
"How's Alana?" he asked his squire.
"Difficult," Curic grunted.
"Unprincipled, abrasive, willful, overbearing, demanding, sneaky, unforgiving. Just your average run-of-the-mill young queen. I like her, though. She reminds me of Flute for some reason."
"I wasn't asking for a description, Curic," Sparhawk said.
I was inquiring as to her health. She seems fine to me. If there was anything wrong with her, she wouldn't be able to run that fast.
Run?
She seems to feel that she missed a great deal while she was asleep, so she's trying to catch up. She's had her nose in every corner of the palace by now. Lenda's seriously contemplating suicide, I think. And the chambermaids are all in a state of despair. You can't hide a speck of dust from her. She may not have the best kingdom in the world when she's finished, but she's certainly going to have the neatest. Curic reached inside his leather vest. Here, he said, pulling out a very thick packet of folded parchment. She wrote you a letter. Give yourself time to read it, my lord. It took her 2 days to write it. How's the home guard idea working out? Colton asked. Quite well, actually. Just before I left, a battalion of church soldiers arrived outside the city. The battalion commander made the mistake of standing too near the gate when he demanded admittance. A couple of citizens dumped something on him.
Burning pitch? Tinian surmised.
No, Sir Tinian. Curic grinned. The two fellows make their living draining and cleaning cesspools. The officer received the fruit of their day's labor, about a hogshead full. The colonel, or whatever he was under all of that, lost his head and ordered an assault on the gate. That's when the rocks and burning pitch came into play. The soldiers set up camp not too far from the east wall to think things over, and late that night a score or so of Platamese cutthroats climbed down ropes from the parapet and visited their camp. The soldiers didn't have too many officers left the following morning. They milled around out there for a while, and then they went away. I think your queen's quite safe, Sparhawk. As a group, soldiers aren't very imaginative, and unconventional tactics tend to confuse them. Platamy and Stragan are having the time of their lives, and the common people are beginning to take a certain pride in their city. They're even sweeping the streets on the off chance that Alana might ride by on one of her morning inspections. Those idiots aren't letting her out of the palace, are they? Sparhawk exclaimed angrily. Who's going to stop her? She's safe, Sparhawk. Platamy put the biggest woman I've ever seen to guarding her. The woman's almost as big as Euleth, and she carries more weapons than a platoon.
That would be Murtai, the giantess, Talon said. Queen Alana's perfectly safe, Sparhawk. Murtai's an army all by herself.
A woman? Colton asked incredulously.
I wouldn't recommend calling her that to her face, Colton, the boy said seriously. She thinks of herself as a warrior, and nobody in his right mind argues with her. She wears men's clothes most of the time, probably because she doesn't want to be pestered by fellows who like their women large. She's got knives attached to her in some of the most unexpected places. She's even got a pair built into the soles of her shoes. Not much of those two knives sticks out past her toes, but it's enough. You really wouldn't want her to kick you in certain tender places.
Where did Platamy ever come across a woman like that? Colton asked him.
He bought her, Talon shrugged. She was about 15 at the time, and hadn't reached her full growth. She didn't speak a word of Aline, I've been told. He tried to put her to work in a brothel, but after she'd crippled or killed a dozen or so potential customers, he changed his mind.
Everybody speaks Aline, Colton objected.
Not in the Tamil Empire, I understand. Murtai's a Tamil. That's why she has such a strange name. I'm afraid of her, and I don't say that about many people.
It's not only the giantess, Sparhawk, Curic continued. The common people know their neighbors, and they know everybody who has unreliable political opinions. The people are fanatically loyal to the queen now, and every one of them makes it his personal business to keep an eye on his neighbors. Platamy's rounded up just about everybody in town who's the least bit suspect. Aeneas has a lot of underlings in Cimera, Sparhawk fretted. He used to, my lord, Curic corrected. There were a number of messy object lessons, and if there's anyone left in Cimera who doesn't love the queen, he's being very careful to keep that fact to himself. Can I have something to eat? I'm famished. The funeral of Archprelate Clavonus was suitably stupendous. Bells tolled for days, and the air inside the basilica was tainted with incense and with chants and hymns solemnly delivered in archaic Aline, a language very few present could still comprehend. All clerics wore sober black in most situations, but such solemn occasions as this brought forth a rainbow of brightly colored vestments. The patriarchs all wore crimson, and the primates were robed in the colors of their kingdoms of origin. Each of the 19 cloistered orders of monks and nuns had its own special color,
and each color had its own special significance. The nave of the basilica was a riot of often conflicting colors, more closely resembling the site of a Comorian country fair than a place where a solemn funeral was being conducted. Obscure little rituals and superstitious holdovers from antiquity were religiously performed, although no one had the faintest notion of their significance. A sizable number of priests and monks, whose sole duties in life were to perform those rituals and antiquated ceremonies, appeared briefly in public for the only times in their lives. One aged monk, whose sole purpose in life was to carry a black velvet cushion upon which rested a dented and very tarnished salt cellar thrice around the arch-prelate's bier, became so excited that his heart fluttered and stopped, and a replacement for him had to be appointed on the spot. The replacement, a pimply-faced young novice of indifferent merit and questionable piety, wept with gratitude as he realized that his position in life was completely secure now, and that he would only be required actually to do any work once every generation or so. The interminable funeral droned on and on, punctuated by prayers and hymns. At specified points the congregation stood, at others they knelt, and at still others they sat back down again. It was all very solemn, and not very much of it made any real sense. The primate Annius sat as near as he dared to the velvet rope separating the patriarchs from the spectators on the north side of the vast nave, and he was surrounded by flunkies and sycophants. Since Sparhawk could not get close to him, the big Pandion settled instead for sitting in the south gallery, directly opposite, where, surrounded by his friends, he could look directly into the gray-faced churchman's eyes. The gathering of the patriarchs opposed to Annius inside the walls of the Pandion chapter house had proceeded according to plan, and the apprehension and imprisonment of 6 patriarchs loyal to the primate, or at least to his money, had also gone off without a hitch. Annius, his frustration clearly showing on his face, busied himself by scribbling notes to the Patriarch of Coombe, which were delivered by various members of a squad of youthful pages. For each note Annius dispatched to Makova, Sparhawk dispatched one to Dolmant. Sparhawk had a certain advantage in this. Annius actually had to write the notes. Sparhawk simply sent folded scraps of blank paper. It was a ploy to which Dolmant had rather surprisingly agreed. Colton slipped into a seat on the other side of Tinian, scribbled a note of his own, and passed it down to Sparhawk. Narrator's note. Nearly every word of the following is badly misspelled. End of note. Good luck. 5 more of our missing patriarchs showed up at the back gate of the chapter house a half hour ago. They heard we were protecting our friends, and they made a run for it. Fortunate, what? Sparhawk winced slightly. Colton's grasp of the spelling of the Aline language was probably even looser than Vanion had feared. He showed the note to Talon. "How does this affect things?" he whispered. Talon squinted. "The number voting only changes by 1," he whispered back. "We locked away 6 of Annius' votes and got back 5 more of ours. We've got 52 now. He's got 59, and there are still the 9 neutrals. That's a total of 120 votes. It still takes 72 to win, but not even the 9 votes would help him now. They'd only give him 68, which makes him 4 votes short."
"Give me the note," Sparhawk said.
He scribbled the numbers under Colton's message, and then added the 2 sentences, "I'd suggest that we suspend all negotiations with the neutrals at this point. We don't need them now." He handed the note to Talon. "Take this to Dolmant," he instructed. "And it's perfectly all right to grin just a bit while you're on your way down to him."
"A vicious grin, Sparhawk. A smirk, maybe?"
"Do your best." Sparhawk took another piece of paper, wrote the information on it, and passed it among his armored friends. The primate Annius was suddenly confronted by a group of church knights beaming at him from across the nave of the basilica. His face darkened, and he began to gnaw nervously on one fingernail. At long last the funeral ceremony wound to its conclusion. The throng in the nave rose to its feet to file along behind the body of Clavonus to its resting place in the crypt beneath the floor of the basilica. Sparhawk took Talon and dropped back to have a word with Colton.
"Where did you learn how to spell?" he asked.
"Spelling is the sort of thing with which no gentleman ought to concern himself, Sparhawk," Colton replied loftily. He looked around carefully to be sure he wouldn't be heard.
"Where is Worgen?" he whispered.
"I haven't any idea," Sparhawk whispered back. "Maybe they had to sober him up. Worgen's sense of direction isn't too good when he's been drinking.
We'd better come up with an alternative plan, Sparhawk. The Hierocracy's going back into session just as soon as Clavonus gets laid away. We've got enough votes to hold Annius off. It's only going to take about 2 ballots to prove that to him, my friend. He'll start getting rash at that point, and we're badly outnumbered here. Calton looked at the heavy wooden beams lining the stairway down into the crypt. Maybe I should set fire to the basilica, he said. Are you out of your mind? It would delay things, Sparhawk, and we need a delay very badly right about now. I don't think we have to go that far. Let's keep those 5 patriarchs under wraps for right now. Talon, without those 5 votes, where do we stand?
115 voting, Sparhawk. That means 69 to win.
That makes him 1 vote short again, even if he can buy the neutrals. He'll probably hold off on any kind of confrontation if he thinks he's that close. Calton, take Perrine and go back to the chapter house and get those 5 patriarchs. Put them in bits and pieces of armor to disguise them, and then form up 50 or so knights to bring them here. Take them into an antechamber. We'll let Dolmant decide when he needs them.
Right. Calton grinned wickedly. We've beaten Annius, though, haven't we, Sparhawk?
It looks that way. But let's not start celebrating until there's someone else sitting on that throne. Now get moving! There were speeches when the still crimson-robed Hierocracy resumed its deliberations. The speeches were, for the most part, eulogies delivered by patriarchs too unimportant to have participated in the formal services in the nave. The patriarch Ortsel of Kadok, brother of the Baron Alstrom in Lamerkand, was particularly tedious. The session broke up early and resumed again the following morning. The patriarchs who were opposed to Annius had gathered the previous evening and had selected Ortsel to be their standard-bearer. Sparhawk still had grave reservations about Ortsel, but he kept them to himself. Dolmant held the 5 patriarchs who had so recently returned to his ranks in reserve. Disguised in mismatched armor, they sat with a platoon of church knights in a squad room not far from the audience chamber. After the Hierocracy had come to order, Patriarch Markova rose to his feet and placed the name of Primate Annius in nomination for the Archprelacy. His nominating speech went on for almost an hour, but the applause greeting it was not particularly fulsome. Then Dolmant rose and nominated Ortsel. Dolmant's speech was more to the point, but it was followed by more enthusiastic applause.
Do they vote now?
Talon whispered to Sparhawk.
I don't know, Sparhawk admitted. That's up to Markova. He's holding the chair at the moment.
I'd really like to see a vote, Sparhawk,
Talon said urgently.
Aren't you sure of your numbers?
Sparhawk said it with a certain apprehension.
Of course I am, but numbers are only numbers. A lot of things can happen when you get people involved in something. Take that, for example.
Talon pointed at a page hurriedly carrying a note from the 9 uncommitted patriarchs to Dolmant.
What are they up to now?
They probably want to know why Dolmant suddenly stopped offering them money, Sparhawk replied. Their votes are worthless at this point, although they probably don't fully understand that as yet.
What do you think they'll do now?
Who knows, Sparhawk shrugged. And who cares? Markova, standing at the lectern, glanced over a sheaf of notes. Then he looked up and cleared his throat.
Before we move on to our initial vote, my brothers, he began, a matter of great urgency has just come to my attention. As some of you may be aware, the Zaymoks are massing on the eastern border of Lamerkand with obviously warlike intent. I believe that we may expect with some certainty that Otha will invade the west, possibly within the next few days. It is therefore vital that the deliberations of this body be concluded with all possible haste. Our new archprelate will be faced almost immediately upon his elevation with the direst crisis to face our church and her faithful sons in the past 5 centuries.
What's he doing?
Sir Bavier whispered to Sparhawk.
Everybody in Kyrelos knows that Oath is already in eastern Lamerkand.
He's stalling, Sparhawk said, frowning. But he doesn't have any reason to stall.
What's Annius up to?
Tinian asked, glaring across the audience chamber at the Primate of Simra, who sat smiling smugly.
He's waiting for something to happen, Sparhawk replied.
What?
I don't have any idea, but Markova's going to keep talking until it does.
Then Bayret slipped into the audience chamber, his face pale and his eyes wild. He half stumbled up the stairs and pushed his way along the bench to where Sparhawk sat.
Sir Sparhawk,
He burst out.
"Keep your voice down, Barrett," Sparhawk hissed. "Sit down and pull yourself together."
Barrett sat and drew in a deep breath.
"All right," Sparhawk said. "Speak quietly and tell us what's happening." "There are two armies approaching Kyrillos, my lord," the novice said tersely.
"Two?"
Euleth said in some surprise.
Then he spread his hands.
"Maybe Worgen split his forces for some reason."
"It's not King Worgen's army, Sir Euleth," Barrett said. "As soon as we saw them coming, some church knights rode out to find out just who was approaching the city. The ones coming down from the north seemed to be Lamarks."
"Lamarks?"
Tinian asked, puzzled. "What are they doing here? They should be on the border facing Otha."
"I don't think these particular Lamarks are interested in Otha, my lord," Barrett told him. "Some of the knights who rode out were Pandions, and they identified the leaders of the Lamark army as Addis and Kroger."
"What?" Calton exclaimed.
"Keep it quiet, Calton," Sparhawk grated. "And the other army, Barrett?"
he asked, although he already knew the answer.
"Mostly Rendors, my lord, but there are a fair number of Camorians as well."
"And their leader?"
"Martell, my lord."
Part 2. The Archprelate. Chapter 10. Patriarch Makova's voice droned on and on as morning sunlight streamed into the audience chamber through the foot-thick triangular panes of leaded crystal in a large round window high up in the wall behind the shrouded throne of the Archprelate. Dust motes hovered golden in those morning streams of light, tracing the elongated outline of each perfect triangle in the still, unmoving air. Makova spoke at great length about the horrors of the Zamok War some 5 centuries ago, and then went into a detailed analysis of the failures of church policy during that period of turmoil. Sparhawk scribbled a brief note to Dolmant, Emban, and the preceptors to advise them of the armies approaching the Holy City.
"Will the church soldiers defend Kyrillos?" Bavier whispered.
"I think the best we can hope for is some token resistance," Sparhawk replied.
"What's keeping Worgen?"
Calton demanded of Euleth.
"I can't even begin to guess."
"Might this not be a good time to make our apologies and leave quietly?" Tinian suggested. "Makova's not really telling us anything we don't already know."
"Let's see what Dolmant says first," Sparhawk replied. "I don't want to give Annius any clues about what we might do at this point. We know why he was stalling now, but let's see what he does next. It's going to take Martell a while to deploy his forces anyway, so we've got time yet."
"Not very much," Tinian muttered.
"The usual course of action in such circumstances is to demolish the bridges," Bavier advised. "That would delay the approaching armies."
Sparhawk shook his head. "There are 10 different bridges across those 2 rivers, Bavier, and we only have 400 knights. I don't think we'd dare risk those men just for the sake of a few hours' delay. Not to mention the fact that the Lymarks coming from the north won't have any bridges to cross at all," Tinian added. The door to the ornate audience chamber opened, and an excited monk hurried to the lectern, his sandals slapping on the polished marble floor and the breath of his passing setting the illuminated dust motes hanging in the sunny triangles to swirling and dancing. The monk bowed deeply and handed Makova a folded sheet of paper. Makova quickly read the message, and a thin smile of triumph crossed his pockmarked face.
"I have just received some important information, my brothers," he announced. 2 sizable bodies of pilgrims are approaching Kyrillos. While I know that many of us are otherworldly and abstracted from current events, it's no secret that certain tensions exist in Eosia at this time. Mightn't it be wise of us to adjourn so that we may use such resources as are available to us, to gather more information about these men, so that we might better assess the situation?"
He looked around.
"Without objection, it is so ordered. The hierocracy stands in recess until tomorrow morning."
"Pilgrims!"
Euleth snorted contemptuously as he rose to his feet. Sparhawk, however, sat staring hard across the chamber at the Primate of Cimera, who looked back at him with a faint smile on his face. Vanion had risen with the other patriarchs and looked quickly up at Sparhawk. He made a curt motion with one hand and moved toward the door.
"Let's get out of here," Sparhawk muttered to his friends over the sound of the excited conversation in the chamber.
The black-robed patriarchs were filing slowly toward the door, their progress impeded by knots of their brothers who had stopped to discuss the matter. Sparhawk led his armored friends out to the stairway and then down to the marble floor of the audience chamber. The big Pandion resisted his impatient impulse to shove assorted clergymen out of his way as he descended. He encountered Annius near the door.
"Ah, there you are, Sparhawk," the thin, gray-faced primate of Cimera said with a faintly malicious smile. "Do you plan to visit the city wall to witness the approach of the throngs of the faithful?"
Sparhawk kept a very tight rein on his temper at that point.
"Interesting notion, neighbor," he drawled in a tone hovering on insult. "But I thought I might go have a bite of lunch instead. Would you care to join me, Annius? Sophrania's roasting a goat, I think. Roast goat thickens the blood, I'm told. And you've been looking just a bit watery of late, if you don't mind my saying so."
"So kind of you to invite me, Sparhawk, but I have a pressing engagement elsewhere. Church business, you understand."
"Of course. Oh, by the way, Annius, when you speak with Martell, give him my regards. Tell him how eager I am to continue the conversation we began back in Dabur."
"I'll be certain to tell him, Sir Knight.
Now, if you'll excuse me..."
There was a faint look of annoyance on the primate's face as he turned and went out through the wide doorway.
"What was that all about?" Tinian asked. "You have to know Sparhawk a little better," Colton told him. "He'd have died before he gave Annius any satisfaction right there. He didn't even blink the time I broke his nose. He just gave me a friendly smile and then kicked me in the stomach."
"Did you blink?"
"No, as a matter of fact, I was too busy trying to get my breath back.
What are we doing, Sparhawk?"
"Vanion wants to talk with us."
The preceptors of the militant orders were talking together tensely just to one side of the huge door. Patriarch Emban of Usera was with them.
"I think our major concern at the moment is the condition of the city gates," Preceptor Abriel was saying.
Abriel's burnished armor and his gleaming white surcoat and cloak gave him a deceptively saint-like appearance, but there was not much of saintliness in his face just now.
"Do you think we can count on the church soldiers at all?" the blue-cloaked Preceptor Darylon asked.
Darylon was a slender man, and seemed not quite robust enough to carry his heavy Daeran armor.
"They could demolish the bridges, at least."
"I wouldn't advise it," Emban said bluntly. "They take their orders from Annius, and Annius isn't likely to put any impediments in the way of this Martell person. Sparhawk, exactly what are we facing out there?"
"You tell him, Bayrit," Sparhawk told the raw-boned young novice. "You're the one who actually saw them."
"Yes, my lord," Bayrit agreed. "We have Lamarcks coming down from the north, your grace," he told Emban, "and Camorians and Rendors coming up from the south. Neither army is actually massive, but in combination they're serious enough to threaten the Holy City."
"This army to the south," Emban said. "How are they deployed?"
"The Camorians are in the van, your grace, and covering the flanks. The Rendors are in the center and bringing up the rear."
"Are they wearing those traditional black Rendorish robes?" Emban pressed, his eyes intent.
"It's rather difficult to say, your grace," Bayrit replied. "They're beyond the rivers, and there's a great deal of dust out there. They seem to be dressed differently from the Camorians, though. That's about all I can really say."
"I see. Vanion, is this young man any good?"
"Very good, your grace," Sparhawk answered for his preceptor. "We have high expectations for him."
"Good. Can I borrow him? And I think I'll want your squire, Curic, as well. I need something, and I want them to go get it for me."
"Of course, your grace," Sparhawk agreed.
"Go with him, Bayrit. Curic's at the chapter house. You can pick him up there."
Emban waddled away with Bayrit close behind him.
"We'd better split up, my lords," Preceptor Comier suggested. "Let's go have a look at those gates. Euleth, you're with me."
"Yes, my lord."
"Sparhawk," Vanion said, "you come with me. Colton, I want you to stay close to Patriarch Dolmant. Annius might try to take advantage of the confusion, and Dolmant's the one he has to worry about the most. Do your very best to keep his grace inside the basilica. It's a little safer in here."
Vanion put on his plumed black helmet and turned with a swirl of his inky cloak.
"Which way, my lord?" Sparhawk asked when they emerged from the basilica and started down the marble steps to the broad court below.
"We'll go to the south gate," Vanion said grimly. "I want to have a look at Martell."
"Right," Sparhawk agreed. "I'd be the last person in the world to say I told you so, Vanion. But I did, you know. I wanted to kill Martell right from the start."
"Don't push it, Sparhawk,"
Vanion snapped tersely as he hauled himself up into his saddle.
His face became grimly set. The situation's changed, though. You have my permission now.
It's a little late, Sparhawk muttered as he mounted Farron.
What was that?
Nothing, my lord.
The south gate of the city of Kyrillos had not been closed for over 2 centuries, and its condition was painfully obvious. Many of its timbers showed signs of dry rot, and the massive chains that operated it were thick with dust. Vanion took one look and shuddered.
Totally indefensible, he growled. I could kick that thing down all by myself.
Let's go up on top of the wall, Sparhawk. I want to see these armies. The top of the city wall was crowded with citizens, artisans, merchants, and common laborers. There was an almost holiday air in the colorfully dressed throng as it milled about atop the wall, gaping at the approaching army.
Watch who you're shoving, one workman said belligerently to Sparhawk. We got our right to look same as you.
He smelled strongly of cheap ale.
Go someplace else and look, neighbor, Sparhawk told him. You can't order me around. I got my rights.
You want to look, is that it?
That's what I'm here for.
Sparhawk seized him by the front of his canvas smock, lifted him out over the edge of the wall, and dropped him. The wall was about 15 feet high at that point, and the breath whooshed out of the drunken laborer as he hit the ground.
The approaching army's out that way, neighbor, Sparhawk said pleasantly, leaning out over the edge and pointing southward.
Why don't you stroll on out there and have a closer look, just to exercise your rights?
You can be very abrasive when you set your mind to it, Sparhawk, Vanion chided his friend.
I didn't like his attitude, Sparhawk grunted.
Neighbors, he said then to those crowded around them, would anyone else like to assert his rights?
He glanced over the wall. The drunken laborer was scrambling toward the questionable safety of the city, limping and wailing incoherently. A place on the top of the wall immediately opened for the 2 pandions. Vanion looked out at the approaching force of Camorians and Rendors.
That's sort of what I'd hoped, he said to Sparhawk. The bulk of Martell's forces is still marching up from the rear, and they're piling up behind the bridges.
He pointed at the vast dust cloud rising for several miles to the south.
He won't be able to get those men here until almost dark. I doubt that his deployment will be complete before noon tomorrow. That gives us a little bit of time, at least. Let's go back down.
Sparhawk turned to follow his preceptor, but then stopped and turned back. An ornate carriage with the emblem of the church prominently embossed on its sides had just emerged from the south gate. The monk who was driving it had a suspiciously familiar set to his shoulders. Just before the carriage turned west, a bearded man wearing the cassock of a patriarch peered briefly out of the carriage window. The carriage was no more than 30 yards away, so Sparhawk could easily identify the supposed clergyman inside. It was Curic. Sparhawk started to swear.
What's the matter? Vanion asked him.
I'm going to have a long talk with Patriarch Emban, Sparhawk grated. That's Curic and Bayret in that carriage.
Are you sure?
I'd recognize Curic 100 yards away on a dark night. Emban had no right to endanger them like that.
It's too late to do anything about it now. Come along, Sparhawk. I want to go talk with Martell.
Martell?
Maybe we can surprise an answer or two out of him. Do you think he's arrogant enough to honor a flag of truce just to demonstrate his advantage at this point?
Sparhawk nodded slowly.
Probably. Martell's ego's a vast open sore. He'd go through the motions of being honorable even if it involved walking through fire.
That's more or less the way I see him, too. Let's go find out if we're right, but don't get so caught up in exchanging insults with him that you forget to keep your eyes open, Sparhawk. What we really want to do is get a closer look at his army. I need to know if it's just some rabble he's scraped together from country fairs and roadside taverns or something more serious. A commandeered bedsheet, although Vanion did offer to pay the frightened innkeeper for it, even as Sparhawk was stripping it from the bed of an upstairs room, provided them with a flag of truce. It popped and flapped quite satisfyingly from Sparhawk's lance as the 2 black-armored knights thundered out through the south gate toward the approaching army. They rode to a hilltop and stopped there. Sparhawk turned Farron slightly so that the stiff breeze caught their improvised flag and blew it out for all to see. Though they were some distance from the van of Martell's army, Sparhawk could hear distant shouts and commands.
The army gradually undulated to a stop, and not long after, Martel, accompanied by one of his soldiers, rode out from the midst of their troops. Martel also carried a lance and a white cape that looked suspiciously like that of a Cyrenic knight flapped from it. Sparhawk squinted at him.
"I wonder," he mused. "Belium brought Alana back from the brink of death. I wonder if I could persuade her to do the same for Martel.
Why would you want to?"
"So I could kill him again, my lord. I could make killing Martel over and over again my life's work with just a little encouragement."
Vanion gave him a very hard look, but he didn't say anything.
Martel wore a very expensive suit of armor, its cuirass and shoulder plates embossed with gold and silver and with the steel itself highly burnished. It appeared to be of Deiran forging, and it was much more elegant than the functional armor of the church knights. When he was within a few yards of Sparhawk and Vanion, he thrust the butt of his lance into the ground and removed his ornate white-plumed helmet. His white hair flowed out behind him in the stiff breeze.
"My lord," he said with exaggerated courtesy, inclining his head toward Vanion.
Vanion's face was icy. He did not speak to the knight he had expelled from the Pandion Order, but motioned Sparhawk forward instead.
"Ah," Martel said, in a tone that might even have been one of genuine regret. "I expected better of you, Vanion." "Oh, well, I'll talk with Sparhawk instead. Feel free to listen in if you like."
Sparhawk also drove the butt of his lance into the turf, and he also removed his helmet as he nudged Farron forward.
"You're looking well, old boy," Martel said. "You look about the same, except for the fancy armor."
"I recently had occasion to do some thinking," Martel replied. "I've gathered up a great deal of money in the last several years, but it occurred to me that I wasn't enjoying it very much. I decided to buy some new toys."
"That's a new horse, too, isn't it?"
Sparhawk looked at Martel's bulky black mount.
"Do you like him?" "I could get you one from the same stable, if you'd like."
"I'll stick with Farron."
"Did you ever civilize that ugly brute?"
"I sort of like him the way he is."
"What are your intentions here, Martel?"
"Isn't it obvious?
I'm going to seize the Holy City. If I were speaking for public approval, I could put a better face on it and use the word liberate, I suppose. But since we're such old friends,
I suppose I can afford to be frank. To put it in plain terms, Sparhawk, I'm going to march into the Holy City and, as the saying goes, bend it to my will."
"You mean you're going to try, Martel?"
"Who's going to stop me?"
"Your own good sense, I hope. You're a bit deranged, but you've never been stupid."
Martel gave him a mocking half-bow.
"Where did you come up with all the troops on such short notice?"
"Short notice?" Martel laughed.
"You don't pay much attention to things, do you, Sparhawk? You spend too much time in Jirok, I'm afraid. All that sun."
He shuddered. "By the way, have you heard from the lovely Lelius lately?" He threw that in quickly, obviously showing off his knowledge of Sparhawk's activities for the past several years in the hope of discomfiting his former brother.
"She was well, last I heard."
Sparhawk gave no hint that he was at all surprised.
"I may just take her when this is all over. She's a significant sort of woman, I noticed. It might amuse me to dally with your former mistress."
"Get lots of rest, Martel. I don't really think you've got enough stamina for Lelius." "You still haven't answered my question, though."
"Thought you could answer it for yourself, old boy, now that I've nudged your memory a bit. I gathered the Lamarcks while I was up there fomenting discord between Baron Alstrom and Count Jarek. The Camorrian mercenaries are always available. All I had to do was pass the word, and they came running. The Rendors weren't that difficult once I'd disposed of Arashim.
Incidentally, he kept croaking the word Ramshorn while he was dying. Could that possibly have been that secret word you cooked up?"
"Very pedestrian, Sparhawk, most unimaginative. The new spiritual leader of Rendor is a much easier man to manage."
"I've met him," Sparhawk said shortly. "I wish you joy in his companionship."
"Oh, Ulysses not so bad, as long as you stay upwind of him."
Anyway, I landed in Arsham, sacked and burned Coombe, and marched on Larium. I must say that Worgen took his own sweet time getting there, though. When he arrived, I rode away and then led him around in circles down in Arsham. It was a way to amuse myself while I was awaiting word of the passing of the revered Clavonus. Did you give him a nice funeral, by the way?
Fairly standard.
I'm sorry I missed it.
There's something else you should be sorry about, Martell. Annius isn't going to be able to pay you. Elana's recovered and cut him off from her treasury again.
Yes, I'd heard about that. From Princess Arissa and her son. I freed them from that cloister as a favor to the Primate of Simera. There was a slight misunderstanding while I was releasing them, though, and all the nuns in that cloister died quite suddenly. Regrettable, perhaps, but you religious types really shouldn't become involved in politics, you know. My soldiers also set fire to the cloister as we were riding away. I'll convey your best wishes to Arissa when I rejoin my troops. She's been staying in my pavilion since we left Deimos. The horrors of her confinement quite unnerved her, and I've been sort of offering what comfort I could.
That's one more you owe me, Martell, Sparhawk grated.
One more what?
Those nuns are another reason for me to kill you.
Feel free to try at any time, old boy. How on earth did you manage to cure Elana, though? I was assured down in Rendor that there was no possible cure.
Your informants were wrong. We found out what the cure was in Dabur. Actually, that's why Sophronia and I were really there. You might call spoiling your plans there in Arashan's tent sort of a bonus.
I was really put out with you about that, you know.
How are you going to pay your troops?
Sparhawk, Martell said wearily, I'm about to capture the richest city in the world. Have you any idea of how much loot's available inside the walls of Kyrelos? My troops joined me eagerly, for no pay at all, just for the chance to browse around in there.
I hope they're ready for a protracted siege, then.
It's not going to take me all that long to get inside, Sparhawk. Annius will open the gates for me.
Annius doesn't have enough votes in the hierocracy to do that.
I rather imagine that my presence here will alter the vote somewhat.
Would you like to settle this right here and now? Just you and me?
Sparhawk offered.
Why should I do that when I've already got the advantage, old boy?
All right.
Try to get into Kyrelos, then. And maybe we can find one of those alleys you're so fond of.
I yearn for the day, dear brother. Martell smiled.
Well, Vanion, has your tame ape here wheedled enough answers out of me to suit you yet, or should I go on?
Let's go back, Vanion said abruptly to Sparhawk.
Always a pleasure talking with you, Lord Vanion,
Martell called mockingly after them.
Do you really think Belion might possibly bring him back from the grave?
Vanion asked Sparhawk as they rode back toward the city.
I wouldn't mind killing him a time or two myself.
We can ask Sophronia, I suppose.
They gathered once again in the red-draped study of Sir Noshan, the portly Pandion who was in charge of the chapter house here. The chapter house, unlike those of the other orders, was just inside the walls of the ancient inner city, the original Kyrelos. Each of the preceptors gave a report on one of the gates of the city. None of the reports was particularly encouraging.
Abriel, as senior preceptor, rose to his feet.
What do we think, gentlemen? He said. Is there any possible way we can hold the entire city?
Absolutely out of the question, Abriel, Comier said bluntly.
End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.